There are people who have suffered and still do suffer legitimate instances of racism, homophobia, etc. The problem is that every time the word racist is just thrown around like that, that word loses its meaning, and it should have quite a sting. That should be a horrible word. There's been an inversion of values.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, universities where you could talk about anything you like, as long as it doesn't make anybody uncomfortable, coddled kitties, and Dr. Peter Boghossian needs a safe space. All coming up next. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett.
I'm Kim Ellington.
Kim, how you doing?
I'm good, Bo. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. What's going on with you?
Oh, you know, a little bit of this and that. Halloween is today.
Yes,
it is. The day we're recording. So I've got a whole bunch of costuming going on in my house with makeup and clothes flying in every direction. How about you?
Well, actually, my daughter's having a party tonight. So, okay, here's an idea.
Oh,
we wanted to, she's a junior in high school. So she's going to be having a lot of juniors over, high school kids. So we wanted to be kind of the parents who are responsible and making sure nothing's going on there and people aren't bringing in any kind of contraband. But we also didn't want to be those kind of nagging parents who are a little bit too much. So my wife and I had an idea. We're going to dress up as TSA agents. And when the kids come in, we're going to like pat them down. And we're going to check their bags, and then we're going to bring them into the basement. Nice. So we could do this under the ruse of Halloween, but yet still checking. How is that for creativity?
I like it. I like it a lot. TSA, man, you're going to be the most hated, at least in my world.
Right. Who are we going to be speaking with today?
Today we're going to talk to Dr. Peter Boghossian. We've spoken to him a while ago. He has his book, The Manual for Creating Atheists. And he has some new things going on, so we are going to talk to him about what he's got going on now.
All right, sounds good. Let's get him on. And Kim and I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Peter Boghossian. How are you, sir?
I'm fantastic. I've been carving pumpkins all day.
Nice. Very timely. Today is Halloween.
It is. It's Halloween, and I wish my pumpkin carving skills were better, but they are what they are.
Nice. Do you do scenes or faces or what?
Well, I have a little pumpkin carving tool, and I've carved a very rudimentary face. Maybe that's probably too charitable for what it is, but I've carved some holes in a pumpkin and called it a face, a jack-o'-lantern.
Have you ever tried carving atheist quotes in a pumpkin?
I actually have not. I'm such a tyro. My pumpkin carving abilities did not extend that far.
All right, fair enough. All right, well, there's a lot of stuff that we could talk about. Being a philosopher, I mean, that's just awesome. That's awesome, isn't it, Kim? A philosopher.
I love it.
Doing that
what
professionally.
What I love about both of you.
Yeah.
That's one response you get.
Yeah, I guess so. But there's so much to talk about and such great things, too. Not just like, oh, how's the weather over there? But being a philosopher, we get to talk about really deep, deep stuff. The one issue that I really wanted to talk about, it's kind of timely. We see it a lot in social media today. And that's this whole idea of what has been dubbed the regressive left. Can you say a few words about that and kind of tell our listeners what that's about and maybe where that term came from?
So the term came from Majid Nawaz, who has a book. Majid coined the term. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Who has a book with Sam Harris that's just come out. It's a wonderful book. I'm in the middle of it now. And the idea, so it's somewhat of an umbrella term. Regressive is a play off of progressive. And it's a term that's used to encompass the authoritarian left, who've made the most bizarre of bedfellows with Islamists. And I use the word Islamist in a very distinct way, different from Islam. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Majid himself is a Muslim. And he's been smeared, he's been attacked by members of the left. They've called him names that I'm not going to repeat on this show. He's done some fantastic interviews recently as his Ayaan Hirsi Ali have been attacked by those on the left. And these sorts of attacks are really beyond the pale. They encompass the most ugly, vile, and nasty elements of humanity. And I think that the term regressive is particularly useful because it differentiates progressive, those people who want to create institutions for racial egalitarianism and racial equality and systems of justice, and those people who are regressive, who look for race when there is no race, who look for the worst in people and do not extend a hermeneutic of charity or a charitable interpretation that anything of anything anyone says, but basically uses that as a hammer to beat people down.
It sounds like the regressive left is a pejorative term given to a certain group of people. Am I correct in saying that, or does anybody actually embrace that?
Nobody I know embraces that term. Okay. It is a pejorative term coined by Majid Nawaz for a type of authoritarianism and a type of dogmatism found among many leftists and their Islamist henchmen.
Okay, so this refers strictly to Islam. So we can't say that this term would encompass some other ideas like safe spaces and trigger warnings.
No. Okay, so that's the thing. Okay, so that's now this is where it gets very interesting. So among the tactics of the regressive left are one of the things we see now on college campuses are safe spaces. And so what my next book is going to be about. I wrote an article about this and I decided to turn it into a book. There are places on campus in which the regressive left seek to protect people from ideas, but not all ideas, only ideas that don't comport with their pre-existing worldview, with this really victimization narrative. And so Jonathan Haidt has written about this, John Lindsay has written about this extensively. The idea being that there are some ideas that are so threatening and dangerous to people that they trigger people. They cause some internal states of panic and emotional turmoil. And so we need to protect people from that. And people who say things that are offensive to other people, not only are they bad people, but those actions are called microaggressions. So I just had an incident the other day, and I can't talk about it too much because it's under investigation by the university, where somebody accused me of being a racist in class because I used a Star Trek example. And I was accused of being a racist, and I said, well, how am I a racist? And this individual said, she said, you assume that she participates in white culture. And it was fascinating to me because I think that incident encapsulated part of the problem of the regressive left. I'm just a guy who likes Star Trek. In fact, actually, Kim, last time I was on your show, I was searching for William Shatner's star. Do you remember that?
I do remember.
In Hollywood. I never found it, but I found the other stars. But anyway, this individual looked at this person on the basis of her race. I did not look at this person on the basis of her race. So she ascribed racist tendencies, or even more egregiously, an explicit type of racism to me when I wasn't even thinking about race. So safe spaces are these ideas on college campuses where ideas are so disturbing to students that you have to not talk about them. And unfortunately, if you teach an ethics class, that's almost impossible. Now, you could do that in accounting class, not even theoretical physics, because that could be triggering. You certainly couldn't do it in any environmental class, because the whole thing is triggering.
Sure.
But interestingly, people are triggered only by certain things, particularly things that have to deal with race and gender. Institutions now, university systems, are being designed around these rules of speech codes of things you absolutely cannot say and things that if you do say, it's met with severe punishment.
This is fascinating. Are these actual, like, little kids have safe places where you're supposed to be able to go if you're lost or if you think a bad person is following you? Is it like that on campus?
Yeah, it's a type of infantilization where people are not rational agents capable of adjudicating moral concerns or making fine discriminating judgments about particular aspects of morality. They're told to refrain from certain types of judgments, and in other type of judgments, they've become hyper-moralists. They've become champions of what they perceive as the victim. It's also driven, this is why this is just so complicated, it's also driven by some legitimate concerns of past horrors created by the United States government, created by the West, of colonialism and slavery. And almost as a rule, you see an inherent distrust of capitalism. You see an inherent dislike of anything that has its origin in the West. And it's artificially inflating or propping up other ideas and epistemic systems and slapping a kind of implicit egalitarianism on them. And I'm sorry if this sounds too academic, but this is a very complicated idea. It's making systems that are inherently unequal equal.
Okay. Let me read the definition of safe space. I looked this up a couple of months ago, and when I first read this in Wikipedia, I thought it was a joke, or I thought that this page was hacked. You know how sometimes people will hack, yes, Wikipedia and say something ridiculous, and then like 10 minutes later it'll be cleared? But I kept on going back, and it actually said this. So I'm going to read this. In educational institutions, safe spaces and positive space are terms used to indicate that a teacher, educational institution, or student body does not tolerate, and here we go, perceived anti-LGBT violence. Okay, fair enough. Harassment. Fair enough. Hate speech. Yeah, what's hate speech? But okay, fair enough. Or disagreement. This is the part that I think is a joke. I can't believe it made it in here. But rather is open and accepting to opinions aligned to his or her own. Is this like an exaggeration that somebody got in here and did this? Or is this...
No.
This is what people who support safe spaces really want. They don't want any opinions other than their own?
Okay, so this is why... So you're a smart guy... I've spoken to Kim. She's smart. I'm going to be blunt with you. Here's your problem. You think this is so insane that those of us who are experiencing this regularly are just making this stuff up, because nobody could possibly want an environment in which everybody sits around and validates everybody else's opinion. Nobody could possibly want an environment in which truth seeking is no longer the goal, but making other people feel good, but self-esteem is the goal. The problem, to be very blunt with you, is that it sounds so crazy that those outside of academia think we're just making this stuff up. Like when I tell you the Star Trek example, I'm sure at some level there's a voice going, come on, I can't possibly. I mean, that's just crazy. Like who? Or maybe it's such a radical outlier. It's actually not an outlier. These things are happening constantly. The whole culture has been hijacked by these regressives, and it's literally destroying our educational system. That makes people more vulnerable to ideas. That makes epistemic systems like knowledge-based systems impossible to critique. That makes cultural systems impossible to critique. It is literally stealing from them their ability to make a moral judgment about any phenomena whatsoever.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. I'm Kim Ellington, here with my co-host, Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Dr. Pete Boghossian.
So is this a problem of definitions, essentially, where you and I may see a definition of hate speech as one thing, and maybe somebody all the way to the left, the extreme left or the regressive left, as you may call them, has a completely different definition that's much more encompassing?
Okay, so I'm going to answer your question with a non-answer. Anybody listening to this conversation who buys into this stuff is going to look at your picture and look at my picture and say, well, those are two white guys. I have no idea what your sexual orientation is. Frankly, I don't care. But,
straight.
You know, they're cisgendered. They're probably heterosexuals. They don't get a voice in this conversation. They don't get a voice for those people who are oppressed. So right from the get-go, we're now dealing with this problem. And again, I want to bring something up that's vital to the conversation. They're the ones who are looking at race and gender. They're the ones looking at my race and gender and your race and gender and excluding us from the discourse. Hmm.
But don't you think they might have a point? I mean, if we are white, heterosexual males, we certainly have not experienced the same kind of discrimination that they've have experienced in their lifetime. So that might make them a little bit more sensitive to these issues than we are. And perhaps what seems like getting way bent out of shape and overreacting on some of these issues, to them, it's an appropriate reaction.
the only way for us to achieve any kind of human liberation is through reason. And the only way that you can align your beliefs with reality is through a dialectic. In the symposium, Socrates throws the slaves and the women out of the room at the beginning of the dialogue. How does that contribute to their flourishing? How does that ameliorate human suffering? How does excluding people from the discourse advance the discourse? It doesn't. What it does is, or people, even people who look like you or have the same sexual orientation as you, it doesn't. What it does is you then converse with people who have your own beliefs and you become more confident that the beliefs you have are true. It deepens your confirmation bias.
Well, Kim, let's get your input on all this. You're a woman. What do you think about all of this?
Well, I think that what I'm drawing a lot of parallels right now is to Facebook. I don't have the, I'm not on a college campus, and I'm disturbed. My first reaction is I'm disturbed at the thought that at a college campus, which is where theoretically you're going to get new ideas and to learn new things, not necessarily to accept, but like you said, learn how to make moral arguments and understand why you feel that way. If you're not allowed to disagree and learn how to disagree in a fair and interpersonal way, that's definitely an issue. And I'm struggling to get my mind around that. Even at our free thought meetings, one of the things that we thrive on is people having different opinions about things and sharing them and trying to come to an understanding of someone else's perspective.
It's worse than that, Kim, because it's not only that you can't disagree, it's that any disagreement is met with an accusation, a personal attack, like a racial attack. For example, if you disagree with an idea, you are a racist. We can't even have conversations. And that's why college disinvitations are ubiquitous now. They're just the norm. That the regressives are uninviting people who have been invited to speak. And when you speak out against that, it's not just a disagreement. When you speak out against that, you are a racist. You are a homophobe. You are a misogynist. You are a bigot. So automatically, any kind of civilized discourse, the possibility to have any rational conversation, the well has been tainted because you are labeled a racist.
Yeah, this is definitely a lot to think about. The fact of the matter is, I do know from my life, my own experience of having friends who are not cisgendered or white or heterosexual, the concept of the microaggression, I mean, I don't know how you feel about the term, but the concept is real. I see it. I hear it. And it frustrates the hell out of me because people don't understand. However, the way to get around that is not to shut someone down. It's to educate and explain. And it's terrifying to think that no matter who you are, an echo chamber isn't getting you anywhere. You need it maybe every once in a while to go ahead and just be like, okay, these are my people. Whew, I'm safe here. Absolutely. We all have those spaces. But then we all go back out in the world and try to make it a better place by sharing ideas and letting each other know what it is. I'm looking at you two as cisgendered, heterosexual, white males. That's your experience. And I would like to know, the fact of the matter is that those of us who aren't you guys, we do still live in a very cisgendered, heterosexual, white male world. You look at our history books and what the kids are learning in school, and I'm really dealing with that right now with my own child. The lack of real diversity there in history is a huge issue. And if our kids are being brought up that way, then they hit the adult world or the college world and they're still being that way. That there's an issue there with the microaggressions of racism.
There are legitimate aggressions, and let me give you an example of those. When you treat somebody differently based upon an exogenous characteristic, so for example, the color of one's skin, one's height would be an example, eye color, what have you. So Kim is right. There are instances when people experience genuine I hate the term microaggression because it's so poisoned. It's just so toxic right now. But when people experience genuine microaggressions, the problem is that we've extended the umbrella from people to ideas. And now people are put upon or aggressed by ideas. That's the problem. And every time, every attempt at creating a safe space is the attempt to buttress people or protect them from ideas. And they've lost the ability to make a discerning judgment between an exogenous characteristic of a person like skin color and an idea like Islamism. That's part of the problem.
So do you think another part of the problem would be this idea of implicit bias, this idea that inside we all might be a little bit sexist or a little bit racist, not necessarily because we're bad people, just because we're human. We tend to favor our own groups or people who are like us. So could microaggressions just really be a manifestation of implicit bias?
I don't think so. So obviously there are implicit biases and things. I don't think you'll find anybody who would argue that there aren't. Maybe you'd find some people on the far right who would say, well, they're implicit, they should be explicit or something. But that's not what I see the goal or the aim or how this, and it really is an ideology, how this ideology discharges itself. That's not an issue as I see it.
So what's wrong with a place where people could go just where they don't feel like they're constantly being challenged?
Well, if they want that, we have a meditation room on campus. You can go there. You're not allowed to speak in the meditation room. You can go there.
You can go on the internet. I mean, right now,
go on Facebook.
You can play. So they have safe. Sorry, Kim. They have these rooms that they've set up with bubbles and puppies and blankets, where the students can go and feel warm and, you know, unthreatened. I don't know how to explain this in any more clear way. This is literally destroying an entire generation of people. It has made them impotent in the face of conflicting ideas. And I just tweeted something out. I think that Shermer had tweeted that now visits to the psychological counseling service centers have gone up dramatically over in the last few years. People can't cope with someone's, the example they use is somebody's called them a bitch. A woman called another woman a bitch who was her roommate, and now she's seeking psychological counseling. I mean, this is so detrimental to people's mental health. Yeah. They are literally creating a mental health crisis on top of destroying the educational system. And this is, I really want to stress again, you know, this is not hyperbole. This is not just me sitting here talking about this. The vast majority of people who teach subjects similar to my own, again, I'm not talking about accounting, humanities. Jonathan Haidt has published things that he got complaints in his class for. The list goes on and on. Students at, I think, Columbia protesting about Ovid and the Greek classics. And there is just no end to where this is going to go. You can be aggressed, but you can feel aggrieved by anything. Anything anybody says, you can take it as a microaggression.
Right.
And you can label them a racist, and you can file a complaint with the Office of Diversity and Inclusion or whatever, that's the one at PSU, and then they'll investigate you, and that your time is stolen.
I'm thinking about appraisal theory while we're talking about this. That's a concept in psychology where basically we take information and we kind of choose to what we're going to do with it, how we're going to feel about it. Some people, for example, if somebody got their bottom smacked as a child, one person could just say, so what? I got my bottom smacked as a child. Another person could appraise it differently and their whole life could be ruined and they could go to counseling and, oh my goodness, and they could call it molestation and so forth. So it's the same physical act. It's just with different ways that we interpret it. And a lot of that has to do with our environment and the social factors around us, like how people respond to that and how people kind of feed into that. And that's what I think we're seeing here. We're seeing a lot of this kind of support for this, especially in social media, where if like anything happens, anything that maybe 20, 30 years ago would have been a so what? Why are you even bringing this up? Now it seems to be a big deal because people want it to be a big deal. People are making it a big deal.
You know, when you were talking, I was thinking about something my mentor said to me. He's a psychologist. He's a 97, a Buchenwald survivor. And, you know, just the most jovial, happy-go-lucky guy. And I had asked him once about his ex, well, more than once spoken about, he was taken in Kristallnacht, about his experiences in Buchenwald, and was that the reason that he was so, you know, jovial? And he said, you know, ah, you know, we talked about Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. He's like, ah, stop bullshit. people have these experiences, and then they have interpretations of those experiences.
Right.
Nietzsche talks about that as well. And he said to me, why is it that some women bounce back very quickly after a rape, and then other women are traumatized for the rest of their lives? They can't even get out of bed. Excuse me. The answer is obviously a complex psychosocial valuation system and, you know, as probably
biological factors as well.
Yeah, biological factors. It extends beyond my area of competence, so I'm not really comfortable talking about it because I don't really know. It's complicated. But what's happened, it's we're trying to create systems as if the most psychologically fragile people inhabit those systems. And the consequence of that is that people who would not ordinarily be fragile, their threshold for what ideas they can substantively engage or even think about is significantly lowered. I want to say one thing that's kind of related. Part of the problem is that there are people who have suffered and still do suffer legitimate instances of racism, homophobia, etc. And the problem is that every time the word racist is just thrown around like that, the problem is that that word loses its meaning, and it should have quite a sting. That should be a horrible word.
Yeah.
But now it's a word like feminist. Feminist should have, that should be a noble term, but it's been poisoned. Now, I think it was the Time Magazine poll of, I can't remember, I think it was Time Magazine, I read it on Twitter, of words that Americans dislike, that they don't respect, and people they don't respect, and feminist tops the list. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason that there's been an inversion of values.
What I find is, I guess, more frustrating than anything else is the anger that people have, specifically like with feminism. We'll talk about that because I'm a lot more familiar with it. You know, there's some feminists out there that I completely disagree with. And they're the ones that, well, you know, we can all call ourselves feminists, right? We kind of self identify. And the ones that are, that go so far, I mean, there was one, oh God, a blog I read that talked about how all sex is rape. Any kind of penis in vagina sex is rape because it's forcible and it causes micro tears in the, you know, I don't even need to go any further. That is not my kind of feminism. That's not, to me, a helpful kind of feminism. But it's out there, right? It exists. And those people should get to talk, but I should also be able to and do say that is absurd. No matter what your experience is, maybe it's time then for you to look at your experience and process it differently in a way that's more helpful, you know, for you to go forward as a human being. And it seems like I'm so caught on the concept of why a college would not want that to happen. And then the college's job, wouldn't it be to, the safe space should be, this is where, these are a bunch of people that want to talk about these concepts without getting into fights, and they want to learn to actually communicate with each other.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And let's take your point even further. But what I'd like to focus on in that comment is, what are the real life practical implications for this? There's a wonderful article I read, see if I can find it, where many law schools aren't teaching, they're not talking about rape issues. and potential attorneys will be attorneys, not even would be, but people who will graduate and take the bar, aren't capable of now defending rape victims because they haven't been taught in law school, because those are considered microaggressions. So in a very real way, women who actually have been raped, and what this means is that women who have been raped cannot find adequate counsel in many cases because we don't teach this in law school.
All right, let's take a step back for a moment, Peter. Isn't what we're actually talking about, at least the core of what we're talking about, values? For example, it has been said that the left tend to value justice a lot more than the right, and the right values freedom a lot more than the left. So in this sense, can it be said that we, and specifically you and I, really value critical thinking? And we know that a critical component to critical thinking is this whole idea of discussion and talk and being confronted with uncomfortable ideas. But maybe other people don't value that as much as we do. Maybe they value this idea of safety. They don't want to be pressured. They don't want to feel uncomfortable. They like to live in their bubble, if we want to call it that, and they're happy that way. And that's a heck of a lot more important to them than critical thinking or reason. Can we really say that something's wrong with that?
Okay. So what you were talking about was Jonathan Haidt lays out the five moral spheres, you know, harm, community, authority, fairness, etc.
Right.
And so liberals tend to score higher on three of those, conservatives tend to score higher on five, and Pinker's written about this and talked about this. So you can look at that as a filter from the first part of what you just said and use that as a kind of heuristic to understand this. Part of the problem is, anytime you want to do an analysis of something like this, you have to have the ability to reflect on what it is that you believe and your ideas. Almost by definition, you don't have that ability because of a safe space, because you have no dialectic. You have nobody saying, well, hey, what about this? Or what about this idea? Or what if someone says this? Or here's a counterexample to that. It almost removes the ability to lead a thoughtful and examined life. To look at your ideology and ask yourself if the views that you hold are the views you ought to hold.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. I'm Kim Ellington, here with my co-host, Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Dr. Pete Boghossian.
To solve any problem, you have to be honest about it. Right. And we're just not honest about our problems. We're not honest about climate change. We're not honest. You know, the left is run rampant with this idea of recycling. It's insane. The whole thing is crazy. We're not honest about our problems with religion. We're not honest about race. We're not honest about anything. And so what we should be doing is creating structures that rewards honesty and authenticity and self-reflection and self-examination. But we have gone exactly the opposite direction. We have created structures that punish those things and smear individuals who are trying to make the situation better to ameliorate human suffering. We have to be honest about our problems. And the way to do that is to truly create a safe space. You know what a safe space should be? It should be a space where people are free to discuss any ideas they want, and people are free to attack any ideas, but not extend the umbrella of dignity from the person to the idea. That's the one of the main problems. And we have to be free to make criticisms of people whose behavior we find abhorrent, and we can't suspend those judgments just because their skin color is different than ours.
Right.
Well, one of the issues that we have, that I feel, again, from my experience, is that it's very, I've heard this concept a lot about making, you know, that I respect the person but not the ideals, and or the ideas don't deserve respecting. The issue is that most people, I think, they consider those two things the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's the problem, because if you attack their ideas, they feel like you're attacking them and not the idea.
Right. That's a great point, Kim. I was going to make the same point. A lot of times the two become intertwined, especially people who, like Christians, people who live their lives at Christianity, that's who they are. All of their beliefs, all of these ideas that are part of their ideology, the Christianity, that is them. You cannot separate the two. So when you're making fun of Jesus or telling a joke, a religious joke, or just pointing out some absurdity in the Bible, you are in effect attacking them, and it's very difficult to separate the two and say, well, that's easy enough just to attack the idea and not the person. In theory, that works, but not in practice.
As a general rule, if you can't see the other side of an issue, you know, maybe the problem's with you, or maybe they're really, you know, there's really no other side to world hunger, to watching people starve when you could do something. There's no other side to throwing people in an oven. And it's an extreme example, but it's meant to be illustrative of a broader point. I think that the part of the problem is that once somebody makes an idea part of their identity, then examining that idea becomes a personal thing. Mm-hmm. It's taken as a personal attack. And we need to help people, again, the root of this whole thing is dialogue. We need to help people see that they are not their ideas, that holding a particular belief does not make you a better person. We can create climates that enable us to teach people basic fundamentals and rudiments of moral reasoning. The only way that you can make your life better and your community better is if your ideas align with reality. If your ideas do not align with reality, and how do you know they align with reality? Well, you use the best available evidence you have. Then you're creating systems in your life. You're creating things outside yourself that you think brings about your flourishing, but doesn't bring about your flourishing. And if you can't even talk about what those things are, then you've made then that's it. We're done for. The whole shebang is over. The whole system. And universities should be places of hope. They should be places where we germinate our best thinkers to engage controversial and difficult ideas. But instead, we're doing exactly the opposite.
So, you know, one of the things that we experience, many of us right now in the United States, is that most people are, we'll just say, are generally moderate. We've seen some studies done where even most Republicans and Democrats actually agree on most things, climate change being one, and that it exists and that it's real. But right now we have a lot of outliers who are running our government. For some reason, they're the ones who end up getting elected. Is this issue are these outliers, the loud outliers on these college campuses that are having these issues? Are there still the students that we think about, I don't know, I guess stereotypically the ones that are exchanging ideas and having debates and meeting on the quad? Maybe I'm being, you know, revisionist history, but this is how it used to be, at least in my experience. Is it just the outliers that are being the squeaky wheel right now?
I don't think so. I think it's creating a climate where professors are just terrified to say anything or write anything. And there's been some, Jerry Coyne has written some really interesting stuff about professors who have written things. And, you know, there's a hierarchy of things you can't talk about. You know, like, look, if I want to put a lecture on tomorrow talking about how bad the pharmaceutical industry is, nobody would say anything. But when I've done my talks, you know, many of the leftists want to shut those talks down. And you would think that the leftists would be very supportive of that. The regressive left, I should make that distinction. So I think that it's not just college campuses. I think college classrooms, excuse me. I think it's college campuses where people are absolutely terrified of being a bigot or being a homophobe or what have you. And they feel that they cannot be honest, not only in a discussion in classroom, but in discussions outside the classroom. And this is what students have told me over and over again. This is not just, and if you speak to, and so the other thing is I can be vocal about this because I really don't care, but many people don't even want to talk about this. And, you know, many people in all fairness are talking about this and they're upset about this. But when you really drill down there, even in those people, you see a trepidation to really expose the full nature of the problem, because they feel that that will have some blowback for their careers. And those are legitimate concerns. I'm not going to whitewash those concerns.
Right. Well, okay. On a much lighter note, let's change directions and talk a little bit about your app you have coming out. What's that all about?
Yeah, we've developed an app. It took far longer than I expected. Developing an app, I must say, I have a new respect now for app developers. It's an app that helps users talk to people of faith and people who hold superstitious beliefs to disabuse them and to have more productive conversations about what it is that they believe and help them break through dogmatism and be more reflective.
So has anybody called this a manipulation tool?
Not yet. You'd be the first to suggest that. No, it's not a manipulation tool. It's how to have more civil conversations, because, as you know, Kim and I have spoken about this, and you know that there's a lot of incivility in the atheist quote unquote community. There's a lot of incivility among people, even in politics in this country right now. And it's a way to have more productive civil conversations. It's not manipulating anybody. It's based in the literature, giving responses to people. You know, you name it, it's in the app just about.
So is this app based off your book, where it uses the Socratic method?
Yeah, somewhat. It's somewhat based on some of the ideas in the book. And it's basically any question that a believer, either a rational believer or, you know, quote-unquote rational believer can say, or someone who believes they have sufficient evidence to warrant belief in their claims.
Okay. Do you have the app right there in front of you?
Yep, right here.
All right. Is it working? Do you have, like, a working copy right now?
Yeah, it's in beta now. It's in late beta. If you go to atheos-app.com, you can see it. If you want, if you email me, I'll send you a beta key. It's literally tens of thousands of fields, just thousands and thousands of fields. And if people get a response that's incorrect, it tells them why the response is incorrect. It has contributors. It has 100 notable atheist contributors in a section. It's also a reference kit, so it points you to – this was an unbelievable undertaking, I'm telling you. Yeah. It points you to books. So if you want to dig a little deeper, you want to learn more about something, videos, podcasts that you can listen to. So, you know, Overlapping Magisteria, you name it, it's in there.
So I'm trying to get a sense of how this works. So let's say you're the atheist and you have this app on you. Let's say I'm the Christian. And is this, if I started a conversation, like I said, Peter, you're completely wrong about this. Jesus is Lord.
Yeah. So what you do is you don't pull it out when you're having a conversation with someone. You pull it out and use it when you're just hanging out with people. I mean, when I read in bed every night before I fall asleep, and I play with the app every night before you fall asleep, or, you know, you're just sitting waiting in the line, you pull the app out and you do it. You just go through some of the questions, you know, sin or the Gospels or Islam or what have you. And then if a believer does approach you, or if you're at a party or a cocktail party or something and the issues come up, you'll have the confidence that you need to engage this, because you've just fit into their cave level. So it's like Plato's caves, you escape the caves. So you don't do this when you're talking to a believer, but there are 5 levels, and each level has awards with it. I can't remember how many, like 20, 30, something like that, awards when you complete a dialogue tree.
Okay. So it's an educational tool, essentially.
It is an educational tool, yeah. Well, it's an educational tool. And the idea is that you want to, if we can get enough people armed with these tools, we can reach a tipping point and put faith in its place.
Okay. All right. And when I went to the website, I saw that it would be available this summer, but I take it you guys are running a little behind on that? Or is it available, but it's just available in beta?
Yeah, it's available in beta, and it will be – we're hoping to have it just in time for the holidays so people can practice when they go to their get-togethers. So it was an amazing experience. I could have easily written another book, maybe even 2 books in the amount of time it took me to do this.
Wow.
But I think ultimately it will be a tool to help liberate humanity. That's my hope.
Great. And it'll be available from the Apple Store, and then also from Google?
Exactly. Cross-platform.
Very good. Do you have a price set for it yet?
No, we're thinking $4.99, and you know, even that won't even cover my costs. So basically, I will have, and I didn't kickstart it. I don't have a Patreon account. This is all, which brings back, by the way, something both you and Kim have talked about, which brings it back to the hostility among the left and the hostility in the atheist community when you're really working so hard and you're not only not making money but losing money, and then people are just mean-spirited. I don't really understand the ultimate motivation, but I'm sure you two are very familiar with some of the nastiness that's occurring. What we really should be doing is to be finding common goals and working together and helping people free themselves of these religious delusions, because their religious delusions are not only trapping them, but they're voting and they're hurting people and they're trapping others. And I really wish that atheists and secular humanists, et cetera, would see that and try to help them instead of either being aggressive towards believers or being aggressive towards people like myself, who are trying to do something about the problem.
Yeah. What you need, Peter, is you need a safe space.
You say space. Well, yeah. Well, I don't know if I really needed a safe. I don't know what I do. Go in a sensory deprivation tank. That would be it, because I'm micro. Look, you gotta, as you know, you gotta have thick skin to do this. So,
all right, that's for sure. Yeah. All right. Well, it has been a pleasure speaking with you. A lot of fun, and I hope sometime we could sit down and talk about some more of this stuff, because it's been great.
My pleasure, Bo and Kim. Very nice to talk to you again. Hope to have an opportunity to talk to you guys again. And I really appreciate you having me on and talking about something that we really need to be talking about, not within the academy, but outside the academy. We really need to make people understand what's happening in our classrooms. And we really need to, in particular, we need to make the people paying the tuition understand, because they can either choose to go to schools that aren't held hostage to regressive leftism, or they can put pressure on their kids' schools. You know, that's the thing that many parents or many students don't understand, is the university is a business. And if enough of their parents, and if they start complaining, they can turn the tide on this madness.
Really, really fascinating. I can't even imagine. It gets frustrating enough dealing with it as an adult, but I can't imagine in a where your job is to create people's thoughts and to help them learn how to think, and to be stymied like that would drive me batty, I think.
Yeah.
Just think about that. The whole idea of asking someone to reflect and formulate their beliefs on the basis of evidence is a microaggression.
Oh, the irony.
Right? I know. I mean that's I can't. If you said to me, give me a recipe to trap somebody in a false view of reality, of course, barring the fact that somebody could be epistemically lucky, that's what I would say it is. I would say, cut off all dialogue. Do not engage them. Do not allow them to engage ideas that run contrary to their own ideas. And if they do, then make sure the person who's responsible for that is punished, is sanctioned, or maybe even removed from the university. And, you know, don't worry about evidence, because if it's true for you, it's true.
Right. Yeah.
That is the recipe to head us off the precipice.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there.
On that positive note.
Thanks so much, Pete.
My pleasure. We'll see you guys. Have a good one.
All right.
You too.
Bye, darling.
Bye-bye. Bye. All right, that was Dr. Peter Boghossian, and we were talking about a lot of different things. One was the regressive left, safe spaces, trigger warnings, and this overall change that's been going on within academia, the college campuses. In our conversation with Dr. Boghossian, I didn't get to talk about it, but I have started teaching at a local university, and I'm teaching freshman psychology, so for the freshman class, Psychology 101. And I have not seen any of this kind of behavior, and it may be due to a lot of different things. Maybe the university where I teach is not a very liberal university. It's not very regressive in that sense. Maybe it's different in Massachusetts a little bit. Maybe not. I don't know. I wouldn't think so, given Massachusetts and the environment and the culture around here. But also that I'm teaching freshmen. And these are students who have just come out of high school. So maybe they haven't adapted to the university life, the college life. They haven't picked up some of the bad habits, may we call them. But next semester, I'll be teaching social psychology to juniors and seniors. So I expect that I might be seeing a little bit more of this as the students become acclimated to the university environment and some of the practices. Now, I, like many people, tend to be skeptical of anecdotal information, even if dozens or hundreds of professors come forward and say there's something going on here. What I like to see is some kind of data, some kind of statistics, some kind of research that has been done to establish this phenomenon that's going on. And we got to remember that it always starts with anecdotes. It starts with people speaking up, and from there, the research is conducted. So this is certainly an interesting area to keep an eye on moving forward. All right. What do you think, Kim?
I think that was a lot of thought-provoking conversation, actually.
Yes.
I'm reminded of all the, I can't remember who it is that said, you know, when you're having a movement or a change, you need the very loud people and you need the very quiet people. And I think we have, between the three of us and everyone else out there, we've got quite a combination.
Yeah, yeah. These issues are always a little bit tricky to talk about. Because especially we know a lot of people in the humanist movement tend to be on one side. And I don't know, I just see a lot of disagreement on these issues in my Facebook and social media feeds, which is a good thing. I think that we really need to disagree on a lot of these different topics, because otherwise we're just picking a side and just buying into everything that one side spurts out, right?
Exactly. And then exactly everything we talked about in the episode, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yep. So, I'm good. I'm intrigued.
Good, good.
Listeners, if you have any comments or feedback for us, you can get us by email at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org, or you can call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371.
All right. Until next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. My safe space.